Diverse, independent, yours. You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM in Burnaby, BC.
Hello and welcome to the Canadian Philosophy Show. I'm your host, Brandon, and joining me once again is Hale.
We've got an interesting thinker who I think was one of these people that was quite influential, but is kind of a little bit less known. Was influential in his own time, but is a little bit less known today. And those are always interesting people to kind of peer into and learn a little bit about just for the sake of themselves.
We're going to be reading today Henri Bergson, but in the French, I think it's Henri Bergson, but we'll just say Bergson. Bergson is an interesting character as far as his life is actually quite, colored. If I said colored, that's like a spotty, it's kind of a bad thing, but it's varied. He was as much of a philosopher, he was also not like a political activist, but he had a public life that was quite interesting. And he is not necessarily like an unknown philosopher. He's a name. I think he's famous enough that Bergson is known as like the duration guy. So like if Heraclitus is the fire guy and Thales is the water guy, Bergson is the duration guy. So he's famous enough to be a guy. He was way more popular in his own time and did fall into a kind of obscurity that I don't know if we'll get into necessarily why that is, but I do think it's interesting why.
He's someone whose name I recognize, Henri Bergson, and I've certainly heard before. This is my first time ever reading any of his work, as far as I'm aware. I believe I encountered some of his work very lately on, it might have even been within the context of doing some work within the philosophy of language, with some of his stuff around intuitionism and stuff like that as well. But he's someone that, you know, is a little bit more obscure now, but it's interesting because, you know, in my cursory reading on his biography, he was extremely popular kind of around the turn of the last century. He was someone that was very, very widely read, someone who was, frankly, it sounds like, critiqued a lot, but also very influential, and was very much considered a kind, in some ways, I think a little bit as well as a popular philosopher, and that he wrote in a style that was relatively accessible, and that he wrote many essays and books that were read by the general public who was interested in philosophy and not just passed around by, you know, fellow academics. And that in itself makes him kind of an interesting player.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, from my looking into his biography too, he was popular not just because he wrote in this accessible style, which seems really interesting just from like a, you know, the history of like philosophy as texts. A lot of that seemed to happen a lot more at the beginning of the 20th century. And I'm also thinking not just within philosophy, but the sciences as well. Like, you can go and just read Albert Einstein's theory of relativity in a book that he wrote for the public. Physicists are writing things for the public. I also think about this in relation to Freud as well. Like, he is this enormously popular figure, and you just see that as having all of these like psychological terms pop up in the English language. Like, we use terms like ego and projection just as day-to-day words, right? People are not necessarily aware that they have their roots in the Freudian psychoanalysis, but because he was writing in this popular style, his works entered the sort of popular lexicon. Henri Bergson is kind of writing in that same style as well. He's also lecturing a lot as well. He goes to the States and he lectures as well. Apparently he causes the first traffic jam in Broadway, which I thought was kind of funny. He was that popular.
That is a funny little tidbit of history there, that he was such a popular philosopher, he caused a traffic jam. The first traffic jam on Broadway in New York, one of many, I'm sure, to come.
Before we get into the particular work that we're going to be reading today, we're going to be reading probably like the first section of his shorter it's not necessarily like an early work. I think he had written two major works before this, but this is definitely a shorter work by him, his Introduction to Metaphysics. Before we get into that, I thought we would do our quote and quandary for the episode. Do you want me to start with kind of a brief quote that I have?
Sure. Why don't you bring up a brief quote? But keep it brief.
Yeah, I'll keep it. Don't worry, it's short. So this comes from Iris Murdoch in her book Metaphysics as a Guide to Morals, which interesting considering what we're discussing today. And she's actually quoting Miles Burnett from the Theaetetus of Plato, and he says, she quotes him as saying, "A great work of philosophy demands a response which is more than merely intellectual." And I think that this is interesting, not just because it's kind of aspirational or inspiring that we should aspire to do more than just, you know, mental gymnastics with our philosophical speculations, or because that's often what we get accused of, right, is that philosophy is just this self-contained cloud of thoughts, and that we should, you know, try and do something a bit more with them. I think it actually speaks to the fact that not only it's more to the fact that we can do more with just our with our thoughts, that there's something related to our metaphysical speculations and our epistemologies and all of these abstract things. They actually can change the way that you approach problems. When you take up a new metaphysic or you see things differently, it actually demands that you follow through with that new conception of, you know, whatever that you're reading in philosophy. There would be something kind of strange about a person who just read philosophy purely intellectually. And it's weird, right? Because we want to say that, oh, you should apply it, but understanding it just would mean changing your behavior in some way, right? Like, it's like metaphysics has values laden into them, right? I think about, in relation to this quote, I think about Professor Brian Van Norden. He has these great lectures on Chinese philosophy, specifically on YouTube, and he says that it's really important to understand a person's metaphysics, because if you want to understand if you want to understand why they take the things they take seriously and are writing the things that they are writing, you go and look at their metaphysics, right? Because that tells you what is important to them and what they are kind of after when they're doing philosophy, right? If you want to not only change or respond to philosophy through your actions, you can see how philosophers act by looking at their metaphysics, right? So there is this relationship between an intellectual understanding of philosophy and a pragmatic or practical approach to life.
Yeah, and I think we'll even see that with a little bit with Bergson, where a lot of, and many other people have pointed this out as well. I also think a little bit, of course, we bring up someone like Heidegger, but even folks like Sartre in the context of metaphysics, in the context of how metaphysics has a sort of, ends up being a process of inward reflection that, you know, and there's all sorts of different ways to describe that. I'm sure many of them would hate the term inward reflection, but a kind of mirror to who and what you are as the being that you are, and how the kind of realization, or even more aptly put, the understanding or intuition, if we're thinking about Bergson, of that can really alter how one lives their life or how one goes about their day or understands even just the simplest interactions, tasks, relationships, all that kind of stuff, right? But I also think that, you know, the claims that philosophy is like very sterile or ineffectual is, you know, dogged it since the beginning of philosophy. And I think that there's also philosophical traditions where this is much less of a great claim. Like when we think about things like political philosophy and stuff like that, like these are absolutely full of ideas whose people, yeah, you know, some of them are pretty obscure ideologies, but a lot of this stuff is very effectual, active, you know, theory that has had really significant consequences, whether that's a deeply philosophical, value-laden document like the Declaration of Independence, to the inner workings and operations of, you know, 1930s Soviet Union, where you had all these sort of ideologue-type individuals operating from, you know, pretty overtly philosophical assumptions about how the world is, the relationships of individuals and society, and how ethics, you know, sort of fits, what kind of ethic fits in there, and obviously the justifications for certain kind of actions. Like, that stuff, I think sometimes people, like, have a tendency to think that, like, they think of, like, classic academic philosophy and then go, oh, well, there's, like, a bunch of people not doing a whole lot. But I think that that's maybe a criticism that can be brought up against a lot of generalized academia in general, and whether or not that's, like, a legitimate criticism at points, where it's like you have people who are just, like, that's what they do. They study, right? They study, they understand, and it's not necessarily, like, all going to be applicable. And that's true with most disciplines.
By virtue of their specializations, which things are getting quite specialized now. And it's interesting that philosophy kind of, there's always something, I feel like philosophy sort of aspires to be as general as possible, which you would think that it makes the most, like, applicable, but it seems to be under the most criticism for being the most sort of useless discipline, whereas the specializations are like, no, this is people who are actually getting down to brass tacks.
So my quandary is pretty, it's taking the quandary pretty literally. I was thinking about the nature of questioning the other day, as a very amateur little philosopher does, like myself. I was like, questions, what are they? But no, I was thinking about how people ask questions and, more importantly, come to answers. And I think I was thinking about, particularly with, you know, so many kind of controversial social or economic issues, especially in our current, in the day of present media, people really want, you know, people ask a question or there's some sort of issue. And a question is brought up into the media sphere. It's brought up into the, you know, the public dialogue, and people want a simple answer, right? And specifically, I was thinking, I saw a news article the other day about safe consumption sites in Ontario shutting down, you know, safe consumption sites. And for those of people who don't know, safe consumption sites are areas designated where individuals who have, generally speaking, significant drug problems, usually around IV use and stuff like that, can go and consume drugs under, generally speaking, under medical supervision, right? And we could do a whole episode on that probably in some sort of ways, or those sorts of, you know, the philosophies and ideologies around that kind of stuff. But that's just, like, the kind of general idea. And, you know, and I saw a lot of people in some comments and stuff responding with, these sites are bad. And in Ontario, there were a few of them. They got shut down by the provincial government, from my brief understanding. Or they defunded them, which effectively shut them down. Now, my quandary about questioning became, it's interesting how we have a tendency to collapse complex issues, especially an issue which involves, you know, this can be applicable to not just consumption sites, but really a whole plethora of issues, particularly issues that have to do with larger issues with society, larger issues with that focus on many individuals. And basically, instead of what happens when one starts to think about the problem that sort of precedes the question, is that really what's populated is many different questions, right? With many different answers. But we have a tendency to want to collapse that into one. So in this case, are consumption sites good or bad? Is basically what the question many people were asking. They're bad, right? Like, in this case, we just, but when in reality, when one would look at, because obviously I work in healthcare and stuff like that, so I'm a little more familiar with the data probably looks a little bit more something like they can be good in certain circumstances, right? And I just thought that it's a, you know, it's, and what actually is behind that is all sorts of questions around, like, questions about where is the right place to put a consumption site? Who should be able to access that kind of site? How is that site being funded? What kind of staff are available? What kind of, what sort of other wraparound sources are necessary or resources are necessary for these to function properly and effectively, right? So basically, it's, I think it's an interesting, almost sociological fact that groups of people, and especially with political motivations, have this intense tendency to collapse complex issues into simple binary-esque questions, like, is it right or wrong? Is it good or bad? Over the aspect of, like, a whole wide area, when the reality is that there's a whole bunch of different smaller questions that have all sorts of different answers, and that in many cases, if not most, if not, I would venture to say all, when we're having a quandary around some sort of larger systemic social political issue, the answer is usually complicated and contingent and relative. But we really don't seem to like that fact about questioning. And so then take that and collapse it into something much more small and simple and apparently easily answered that might not actually be particularly reflective, or more probably a better way of putting it is have much content around what the actual issue is and the facts relating to that issue as we understand them.
Yeah, I think that's a good way of kind of saying it, is like, it does reduce, like, you have all of these complications, like, not complications, they're just the particularities of, like, a given issue, right? If a person was to just ask a broad question like that, we might call raising those kinds of questions qualifications, like introducing different particularities and trying to qualify what we mean by good or bad, and transferring, like, this general sense of, like, good or bad to, okay, well, it might be good or bad, but only in this, like, one part. Or, you know, what part of it are you talking about that is, like, good or bad? Because a whole process, I suppose, can be good or bad, but a whole processes like this have parts, right? But it's interesting that you mentioned that kind of by the end of asking this general, like, is it good or bad, it almost, like, it deflates the question in a way. This complicated process that really does have all of these parts and which could be investigated fruitfully and productively in this, you know, varied way, almost becomes, like, meaningless and unproductive and kind of, like, almost reactionary. Like, if we were to ask, like, are safe, you know, like, safe injection sites, are they good or bad? Like, what circumstance would that be, like, an appropriate question, right? It seems like such a broad circumstance that, like, you'd have to qualify that before that was ever, like, a productive question or a question you could do something with, right?
Yeah, which then I think extends out a little bit with the initial, like, the nature of the question, which is obviously we, like, all of us, part of being the kind of beings that we are and think about the world is that we ask questions, but also how we operate together as a community, which obviously enters into the political sphere, these questions come about. And then it becomes an issue more of, like, the questions themselves really aren't questions. I think they become more like political markers and motivations and justifications that oftentimes, as I was saying earlier, don't actually contain all that much content around the issue that they're purporting to ask a question about. And it tends to be more reflective of other political motivations, issues, beliefs, ideologies that, again, might not actually have much to do with, you know, trying to have some sort of calculus around whether or not such and such issue is legitimate or good or bad or effectual or ineffectual or whatever, right? And it's just interesting how the processes of questioning really, like, can have veiled motivations, essentially, right? Which is, I mean, I guess is unsurprising, but it's certainly the case.
Yeah, well, I mean, question, like, any question is going to be based on some kind of perspective of salience, right? And you can almost, like, kind of superimpose that perspective by raising a certain question, you know, and you can kind of detect the salience in a particular question. And if you're good at sniffing this stuff out, you can be like, you can be skeptical about it and be like, you know, this seems like an innocuous question, but what is actually like being framed by raising this question rather than particularities or even like completely alternate like questions that like don't even touch on like this, you know, facet of the problem and like talk about something else, like with safe injection or something. Like, we're talking about it being good or bad, but why aren't we talking about, I don't know, like something else that contributes to it but has no like general relation to the sites themselves, right? Like, I don't know, poverty or something.
So now should we ask a few questions about Bergson?
Yeah, let's get into discussing his short work, The Introduction to Metaphysics. Now, the work itself is broken up into three parts. The second one is overwhelmingly the majority of the book, but I think that we're going to be discussing mostly the first part, where he raises some of the central distinctions that are, and some of the central distinctions and the central concepts that are going to sort of conceptually underpin much of the rest of the exploration that he goes into. I don't know how much we're going to get into that. Probably not a lot, and we might just anticipate it. But in any case, we would still make, we would still come to a certain understanding of Bergson's philosophy if we understood these important distinctions that he's raising in the first part of the work. Bergson is going to say, and I'll just read it. I think your translation is a little different, but I don't think it will be an issue for the listener either way. If we compare the various ways of defining metaphysics and of conceiving the absolute, we shall find, despite apparent discrepancies, that philosophers agree in making a deep distinction between two ways of knowing a thing. The first implies going all around it, the second entering into it. The first depends on the viewpoint chosen and the symbols employed, while the second is taken from no viewpoint and rests on no symbol. Of the first kind of knowledge, we shall say that it stops at the relative. Of the second, that wherever possible, it attains the absolute. So Bergson is going to draw a distinction here between the relative way of knowing a thing and the absolute way of knowing a thing. Now, what's really important, and kind of just to anticipate, you know, to make sense of why Bergson wants to draw this distinction, Bergson is going to ultimately argue that metaphysics is a discipline that sort of relies on one of these particular ways of knowing a thing. Metaphysics is the science which knows things absolutely, while what we call the sciences are relative sciences. They are comparative sciences, and they rely on symbols to express relations. Obviously, it begs the question, okay, well, what does this mean, right? Now, for Bergson, to understand something relatively, as he says, is to go about a thing, to go around a thing, right? That is to take various perspectives on it. So if you pick up anything around you and you start looking at it, you can turn it around, you can position it closer or farther away from you, but all of these different perspectives on the thing are relative, right? They're relative to its position to you. They're relative to the conditions that you see that thing under. So like maybe various lighting, almost anticipating, you know, phenomenological aspects of it. And later on into the book, he'll explicitly explore this stuff. But the sort of almost like psychological conditions that you find yourself in, your particular way of like how rash you might be feeling or how distracted or how bored you might be, sort of condition how you see this thing, right? But to understand something absolutely, he says, takes no viewpoint at all. And that should confuse us, because it would be curious to know, it's curious to think about what it would look like to know something without a perspective at all, right? To kind of have a God's eye view in a certain way. which metaphysics has always kind of aspired to, but
I think absolutely. And one of the ways I thought about this, as I was reading, and Bergson has some real, particularly, frankly, we'll get into it, but I think so, some of Bergson's descriptions and sort of breakdown of how knowing things relatively speaking is quite interesting. But I think the differences are the way I think about it, or maybe the audience is like, you know, both you and I say we know the same dog, or you and I have a dog, right? We both live with this dog, and et cetera, et cetera. We are going to have a conceptual understanding of this dog through all the various kinds of datum that we have, that while probably very similar, is never going to be exactly the same, right? Whereas if some, like, just to say in this case that somehow we had metaphysical knowledge of the dog, what that metaphysical knowledge would be in this case would be identical regardless of the viewer, right? Like, no, I'm not claiming metaphysical knowledge of the dog we both have, but if we did know this dog, as Bergson said, you know, from being on the inside, we would both have this, the data of the knowledge would be the exact same. There would be no differentiation.
Yeah, that's interesting. It's right there kind of in the text, but I'm glad you're bringing this kind of way of understanding the distinctions up, because I hadn't thought about the importance of that, that in a certain way, it's almost as if Bergson is setting up the sciences to be relative, but that also means kind of subjective. Like, if we're both looking at the same dog, we can only see the dog with our eyes or hear it with our ears from our own perspective. But if we attain an absolute understanding of it and we enter into it, not only does that mean that we're going to have the same understanding because we're going to grasp the same truth, but it's going to be actually objective, right? It's going to be what people actually aspire to kind of grasp when they want to claim to know something, which is something not just certain, but something that you and I both understand. There is no problem of commensurability here, right?
Yeah, ideally, I think within the context of metaphysics, there would be no problem of commensurability. I think they're probably the way, you know, dog is not a good example, but the example that's often used by other metaphysicians would be something like, you know, numbers or mathematics, where regardless of the individual situation, time, place, now, there are people who would obviously debate this, but like, you know, 2 + 2 = 4 is always what that thing is, regardless of who that knowledge is transferred to or who interacts with it or whatever it might be.
Right. And when we understand that, we both understand the same thing. We don't come to that metaphysical understanding of an absolute like that with our own kind of personal baggage. You know, I don't have like, I don't understand 2 + 2 = 4 differently, you know, from moment to moment, just because I'm bored or excited or feeling smart because I know 2 + 2 = 4. We understand the same thing, not only across people, but across ourselves in that way. That distinction between the relative and the absolute way of knowing something is a central distinction that Bergson is going to rely on throughout this whole work. He goes into various sort of examples, and I think this is the other element of his writing as well, as we were talking about before, is that he's going to use examples and he's going to try and get a general reader to understand what he's talking about, because we're talking about metaphysics here, which seems kind of highfalutin, mystical, or maybe even obscure, but it should be intelligible to anyone if what Bergson is talking about is correct, that to understand something absolutely is for you and I to have the same understanding. So in a certain way, it feels weird to say, but metaphysics should be the most popular philosophy because everyone should be able to understand it, right?
Well, it certainly has the potential to be the most equitable.
Yeah. So in any case, he starts by talking about a good example that I think physicists tend to use when they want to talk about relativity, which is the movement of a body through space. So he talks about how when something moves through space, it has a point A and a point B, and you can analyze it.